Well, shall we get started, Sam?
Yes, please, let's.
All righty, let's do it. Well, welcome, listeners, to episode 13 of Know Your Enemy, Lucky 13.
Lucky episode 13. Yeah.
I'm actually kind of superstitious, but we're not going to call it episode 14. We'll call it episode 13.
My dad grew up, I remember my grandmother lived in an apartment building in the Upper West Side, and she lived on floor 14, but it was actually floor 13.
right, yeah. That's a thing. And this episode, we're going to talk about Norman Podoritz's memoir, Making It. Hmm. And our guest to help us talk about it is David Kleon. David's the news editor for Jewish Currents. You've probably seen his byline all over the place, The Nation, The New Republic.
You've probably seen his tweets.
And you've probably seen
his
tweets.
Let's be frank.
Yes. He's a, as he was once called by New York Magazine, he's a ubiquitous Twitter pundit. And he is ubiquitous, and he was here with us today. And the conversation we had with him, we'll share in a few moments. So who is Norman Podoritz? If you've heard of him, it's probably because he is one of the major figures of what is called neoconservatism. Mm-hmm. That is, he was a Jewish intellectual who in the 1950s and 60s was kind of on the left or a part of mainstream liberal intellectual culture,
right,
mostly in New York, who moved right. So he was born in 1930. He's still alive, so he's in his 80s now. And he edited Commentary magazine, mm-hmm, until the mid-90s. So he became editor of Commentary when he was in his 30s. It must have been right around 1960, I believe, when he became editor of Commentary. So he was a major figure in American conservative letters, you might say, for most of the second half of the 20th century. And Making It is just... We mentioned this in the conversation that follows, but it's really a very compelling read, I found, especially if you have a taste for high-end gossip, you might say, intellectual gossip. It takes us from his origins in Brownsville, Brooklyn, through Columbia, through Cambridge, through kind of him scaling the heights of the New York literary world. And again, because it's published in 1967, this book comes out before Podoritz really makes his turn to the right, mm-hmm, though, as we discuss... You can kind of see it coming, or it's not a surprise, I should put it that way.
So this book was reissued in 2017 by the New York Review of Books imprint, which is sort of an interesting phenomenon. For one thing, because it was very, very poorly received when it came out, including by the editors of the New York Review of Books, which is sort of
There's a certain irony in...
An irony that Norman Podoritz has said that he appreciates, but... It really is important to, and we do get into this in the conversation with Dave, that the fact that it was received so poorly is a very important part of his trajectory and of understanding sort of like what this memoir meant at the time, understanding the times in which it was received.
It is an interesting window into the times, in part because you realize this group of New York intellectuals was actually quite small.
Yeah.
And so the personal elements...
It's dirty laundry.
It's dirty laundry, yes. And the personal elements, the grievances, the rivalries, you know, he lays them all bare. But it's also one of the pleasures of reading it is that it's a description of what's now kind of a lost world. And mm-hmm, I admit to a certain nostalgia for that world myself. Yeah. I'm not saying it's justified, but he does capture the hothouse world of, you know, all the writers and editors and intellectuals being at the same parties, sometimes with celebrities mixed in, Lauren Bacall or Jackie Onassis, right? Mm-hmm. Who are people he mentions by name in the book.
He's a famous name dropper.
Famous name dropper. And in fact, one of the famous lines from this book is that he almost compares your social standing at these parties in New York to the New York Stock Exchange. Like there's a ticker, and every morning, just as you might check your stock numbers, are they up or down? Every morning, every Saturday morning or Sunday morning or Monday morning after a weekend of partying, you would say, well, who was at this party? Who was at that party? And what does it say about the relative standing among this social set in New York?
Twitter would have really destroyed Norman Podoritz, as it to some degree has destroyed his son, John, who is now...
John Podoritz is the editor of Commentary now.
Yeah.
Yes. At the end of Making It, Podoritz references Norman Mailer, and we do note that, but... When Mailer stabbed his wife, it was Podoritz he turned to, And it was Norman Podoretz who actually like walked him
to the police.
To the police, so he turned himself in.
Yeah. Take from that what you will.
Right.
About what he was willing to tolerate.
Right. So just, it is a great book if you're interested in the New York intellectual scene in the 50s and 60s.
Yes, it is. And I guess like for the purposes of this conversation, it's kind of a jumping off point to try to make sense psychologically, ideologically, pathologically, like what it is that causes a person in his circumstances to move from sort of a liberal left position to a right-wing position. Mm-hmm. There's just an enormous amount of fodder in this book, especially because, I mean, to his credit, he like lays bare his pathologies and his fears and desires and obsessions in such a unapologetic way.
And so we just felt like this was a very rich book that touches on a lot of themes that we're concerned about in the show, and that just provides a really interesting window into American life during a certain period of time.
You kind of wish that like every prominent conservative intellectual had written a book like this in their mid-30s. It would make everything much more legible and understandable. I will say, too, that Jewishness, New York Jewishness especially, plays a huge role in his story and the way he understands himself and the trajectory that his career takes.
Yeah, so I've made Sam suffer through so much Catholic shit. We thought it was time to turn to a Jewish intellectual, since I've made Sam and we've made all of you, our listeners, suffer through a lot of intra-Catholic disputes. So
yeah, right. This is a very Jewy episode. We really Jewed it up for this one.
We'll turn to that conversation in just a moment. A few housekeeping items.
Housekeeping.
Yes. As always, we are grateful to our partners at Dissent, who sponsor the podcast, for helping us spread the word about it.
Dissent Magazine, which plays a role in this.
Yes. Irving Howe, the founding of Dissent. Podoretz kind of looks down his nose about it a bit.
He's like, oh, a new thing. Whatever. Yeah.
But we're grateful to our friends and partners at Dissent. Again, they offer the free digital subscription if you're a West Coast Straussian subscriber on Patreon or above. So if you're interested in that, check us out on Patreon. As always, rate and review us on iTunes. Leave a comment if you care to.
It's very, very much appreciated, everyone who contributes on Patreon. It makes it possible for us to do this. Frankly, it makes it possible for me to pay my rent. And we love doing it, and we love your support. So if you've been thinking about supporting us on Patreon, maybe now's the time. There's going to be more and more.
It's the giving season.
It is, after all, the giving season. Anyway, thanks so much to you. And I think that's it.
Well, stay tuned for our conversation with David Kleon about Norman Podoretz's Making It.
We go.
All right.
Pod.
All right. Well, welcome to Know Your Enemy, David Kleon.
So glad to be here. Thrilled.
Yeah, we're excited. And you're the perfect guest to come on to talk about Norman Podoretz's 1967 memoir, we might call it, Making It. Now, who is Norman Podoretz?
So Norman Podoretz, I would say, is probably best understood as one of the foundational neoconservatives. And maybe in order to situate him a little, it's a good idea to just say quickly, who are the neoconservatives? You see the term tossed around today, and I would say the kind of layman's understanding of it is a very hawkish, pro-Israel, almost invariably Jewish conservative figures who, in the kind of young millennial leftist mind, are most associated with the George W. Bush administration, the war in Iraq, subsequent efforts to strike Iran or Syria or maybe Venezuela or North Korea, or just kind of solidarity with the Likud faction in Israel. That's how we think of them now, and that is where a lot or most of them have kind of ended up. a lot of them are also never Trumpers, which we can talk about later. But that's really not how it starts. It is true that it starts primarily as a movement of Jewish intellectuals based primarily in New York. That's true from the beginning. But really, it was not about Israel, and it was not about, mostly not about foreign policy. To the extent that it was about the Cold War.
Yeah.
And about being, I mean, most of these guys came out of the tradition of being either Trotskyists who swung to the right, or I would say Cold War liberals who, or sometimes they became Cold War liberals on the way between Trotskyism and the right, who were anti-Stalinist and who kind of came to believe in America and the West, but retained some of the polemical and analytical habits of mind and argumentative style of the early 20th century Jewish left.
They stopped being Marxists, but sort of temperamentally they stayed Marxists.
Yes. And a core group of them, well, a core group of very influential 20th century New York public intellectuals met as students at City College in, what was this, the late 30s, early 40s, and maybe the single most foundational figure of the neoconservative movement, Irving Kristol, father of Bill Kristol, was one of them. Norman Podhoretz, our main subject today, was not in the alcove with the rest of them debating Trotskyism.
And we should say the alcove was like a where they ate lunch in the cafeteria at City College.
They were Alcove 1, but they were the Trotskyists.
And Alcove 2 was the Stalinists.
Yeah, and they hated. These are all basically working-class Jewish boys, like usually the sons of immigrants, you know, going to City College, who are like smart enough to go to Harvard, but there's quotas.
Yeah.
So here they are at City College, and they're fighting about Stalinism versus Trotskyism. And, you know, however one feels about politics today, I imagine for us and for a lot of our listeners, you can imagine the scene with a certain nostalgia, right? Like you would have been there. What side would you have been on, and so on?
Yeah,
Podhoretz was not in that alcove. He had a different trajectory. If you want to talk about that,
yeah. No, so he was a little bit younger than Irving Kristol and company. His intellectual life was not forged in the City College alcoves, and instead he went to Columbia, and he studied literature there. He kind of very early on, he had ambitions as a poet, but he quickly realized that like the critic was the dominant figure of the age. He studied with Lionel Trilling at Columbia, among others, and then went to Cambridge on a Fulbright scholarship, where he studies with Leavitt, L-E-A-V-I-T-T, a kind of famous English critic at the time, who was the editor of Scrutiny, kind of a high-end literary journal. So his background's more literary. After he's done at Cambridge, he comes back to the United States. He starts writing reviews. He had published some in England. And then he goes into the military during the Korean War. And
he didn't actually serve in Korea, did
he? No, but he describes his experiences in the military, and I think one of the more interesting kind of set pieces of the memoir. Right. And then he comes back to New York, and he's kind of off to the races, publishing as much as he can, making his way in the New York literary world. And the book really takes us from, again, his childhood in Brownsville to Columbia, to Cambridge, to the military, back to New York, and kind of his effort to, as the title indicates, make it.
Yeah, and we should just mention, I think, a little bit about Brownsville here, because it may not be familiar to people. Brownsville is a neighborhood in eastern Brooklyn that, no matter how much you've heard about or experienced or participated in the gentrification of Brooklyn, is not really there yet. Today, it's an overwhelmingly African-American neighborhood, and it's definitely one of the poorest neighborhoods in New York City. But it was a very poor and heavily, though not exclusively, Jewish neighborhood. It was Jewish and Black, I think, among other things.
Importantly so for Norman.
Yeah, for reasons we'll get to. He grew up working class. His parents were immigrants, I think, from Galicia in Austria. And he has, and I would say this is central to the narrative of the book, a kind of giant chip on his shoulder about that.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, maybe the biggest chip ever recorded on anyone's shoulder. The book begins with him saying he's about to do something extremely impolite, which is to say that he's proud to be successful and to make money and to to have made it.
The beginning of the book is, let me introduce myself. I am a man who, at the precocious age of 35, experienced an astonishing revelation. It is better to be success than a failure.
So the context for this, I mean, you can't understand this book and you can't read it with 50 years hindsight without understanding the impact that it had. Because basically, he decided to do a kind of tell-all about the uptown New York literary scene. And this is a guy who made it from the kind of most poor backwater outer borough neighborhood to the Upper West Side of Manhattan and the kind of intellectual and literary elite. And, you know, he's in what he refers to as the family that includes many of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century: James Baldwin, Hannah Arendt, Susan Sontag, and Norman Mailer, you know, really bold-faced names. And he's in those circles. And here's a book where he explains how he got there, and he's kind of unabashedly bragging the whole time about how smart he is, how hardworking he is, how everyone was always impressed with him all the time.
It's embarrassing to read. It's an incredible experience.
Both embarrassing and delicious. You're like, no one ever actually says these things out loud, and here he is. And you can tell he thought as he wrote it, I'm doing something really gutsy here, but I'm going to stick the landing. People are going to be like, I can't believe you wrote this, but it's brilliant and it blows our world open and it's great. But that's not what happened. What actually happened is that everyone just hated it and everyone trashed him for it. And his life went into a spiral.
Yeah, I mean, Podoretz was about my age when he wrote this book. He's talking about his grades, his college grades. Yeah, and he goes out of his way to say, I got A pluses. No one got those except in the hard sciences at Columbia. And he talks about how unusual a grade it was. But this is an adult man talking about his college grades like that.
He talks about all the prissy middle class Jewish and WASP kids at Columbia.
Who he lumps in with the gays.
Who he lumps too. In with the gays.
Tellingly, I think.
And he sort of sees them as like, oh, you know, they were smart, but they were never going to brag about their grades. But they also weren't as smart as me. And they hated me because I was doing even better than them. And I mean, it's nuts. It's
hard to nail down because there is something admirable about it, which is that, you know, people do think of their lives in these terms, even if they have these sort of aspirations to like art, living a life of high pursuits. They nonetheless think about fame and success and money and things like that. And what his sort of intervention was to say, like, all these people, and especially the sort of like people from like middle class and upper class backgrounds who devote themselves to the arts, it's impolite to acknowledge the fact that also what we're trying to do here is like increase our social standing. And on the other hand, it seems like one of the fundamental misunderstandings of the book and maybe of his entire life and output is that he assumes that everybody thinks exactly the way that he does. Like, so he looks out at the world and he sees, well, everyone is obviously just like me, just as ambitious, just as cutthroat, just as self-interested.
And also, and I think importantly for where we're going to go with this, so ideologically vacuous. Because, you know, say what you will about Irving Kristol or a lot of the other early neocons or the New York public intellectuals who parted with the left. They were intellectuals, and they had a big, comprehensive political understanding of how the world was supposed to work. And Norman Podhoretz, I mean, he was certainly an intellectual. He was a literary critic. He's actually a very good writer at this stage.
This book is lovely. Yeah. It's very well written. It's actually very surprising that, I mean, okay, as we acknowledge, it was panned by his scene. They all hated it. It was reviewed very poorly. But the striking thing reading it now is like, God, this is a good writer. A lot of people, I mean, most books suck. This is a good book.
Well, I guess so. We should make clear, at the time he wrote this book in 1967, he's basically just a Cold War liberal. You know, he's anti-communist, mm-hmm. but he's a liberal. He's an Upper West Side liberal. Mm-hmm. He's the kind of person who would probably vote for Pete Buttigieg today. But he's not, in fact, today a supporter of someone like Pete Buttigieg. He later goes on to be, in the wake of this, he supports Nixon, he supports Reagan, he enthusiastically supports Rudy Giuliani and George W. Bush. And he is now, he defines himself as anti-Trump, which is notable because most of the neocons have at least made a show of being never-Trumpers, but including Norman's son, John. But Norman sees a kindred spirit in Donald Trump. And arguably this book and the reaction to it is the pivot point of his life, certainly of his political life, because it's the moment where the liberal elite he spent the first 35 years of his life trying to break into rejects and mocks him, and he never seems to get over it.
Yeah. Now, one thing by way of background, some more background on the book, I mentioned it was published in 1967. Very interestingly, the New York Review of Books publishing imprint put out a 50th anniversary edition in 2017. And that was interesting because it allowed people to look back on his career and preoccupations and trajectory, knowing that Trump had just been elected and that this guy was anti-Trump, but clearly someone who more or less was sympathetic to Trump in a lot of ways. Yeah. So that timing in itself was interesting.
Right. So I actually wrote an article in 2017 about that. That was when I read this book for the first time in the NYRB 50th anniversary edition. And I ended up writing an essay about this for Jewish Currents, the publication I now edit for. And in that, I was struck both by, and I wasn't the only one who was, as I note in there, Jeet here at the New Republic at the time also saw real personality parallels between Norman Podhoretz and Donald Trump, which is such an odd thing because, you know, you have, I mean, they're both outer borough guys of a certain era. Podhoretz is older, but, you know, one of them is this Jewish intellectual who likes poetry, and one of them is Donald Trump. But if you dig a little deeper, you see that they're both articulating a politics of almost pure resentment. So one thing that I've been kind of struck by again and again in the last 3 or 4 years since Trump kind of arrived seriously on the national scene is almost all the neocons were never Trump. But since he was elected, they've kind of gone off in two directions. So one set of neocons, your David Frum, your Jennifer Rubin, your Bill Kristol, Max Boot. I'm not fans of any of them, and they were all big Iraq War boosters and so on. But they all stuck with the never Trump thing and became what we would call resistance libs or centrists now. Whereas another set, I would say, without fully embracing Trump, you know, they still maintain that they're anti-Trump, has spent most of the last 3 years punching left rather than freaking out about Trump's authoritarian threat to our democracy. And Norman was really a forerunner of that. And I feel like you can look back on the neocons over many decades with this as hindsight, and you can see that there are sort of two distinct traditions that appeared to be one. One is this kind of actual intellectual tradition based on, you know, American global hegemony and a certain set of concrete values that coincided with the Republican Party for many years and now feels genuinely like Donald Trump has taken things in another scarier direction. Another is this movement composed of just kind of pure resentment and like trolling and triggering the libs and as sort of the core of what it is. And Norman Podhoretz articulated that almost perfectly, the essence of it, in 1967 and ever since. And it's clear which of those defines the Republican Party today.
Yeah. Now, this book, Making It, that's a good comment, I think, to jump off of, because there's a few themes to the book that he lays out right away. One is, as Sam kind of alluded to earlier, the idea that, well, he quotes William James, the bitch goddess success that animates American life. Yeah. But the fact that, especially in the more elite, upper middle class, upper class milieu, you're not really supposed to admit that success and ambition, fame, money are what you're searching for.
Yeah.
So part of the conflicts early in the book are he shows up at Columbia and all these better bred young men are like feigning disinterest. They don't want to seem like they're working too hard. Well, he's the striving working class kid who's just seems totally earnest. He talks about imitating his professors. So that's what he announces is the theme of the book, that he's going to be the one, as Sam pointed out, to kind of tell it to us straight.
Yeah.
But there's also, well, the class dimension that this implies. And Sam read the very first sentences of the preface, but the first chapter has another great opening line, which is that one of the longest journeys you can take in America is from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And then he clarifies certain parts of Brooklyn to certain parts of Manhattan. So that's an element. And of course, the Jewish element is there. And I think in some ways, it's the Jewish element and the generational element combined that kind of propel the book forward, both in terms of how you understand the neoconservatives David has been talking about. That is a Jewish generational story in a lot of ways. But also Podoretz's place within the family, the mostly Jewish set of intellectuals in New York who he was trying to kind of find his way into. He talks about the different generations of them. Yes. And that he was essentially a third generation family intellectual. Yeah. And what that meant. And I think this is actually one of the more subtle but most telling ways his narcissism expresses itself, which is you can kind of tell the problem with where the direction the family went was they didn't realize that he kind of dialectically fulfilled where the family's trajectory was going. There's the first generation of Jewish intellectuals, which maybe their parents were directly immigrants. They were a little more alienated from American life in a lot of ways. And the second generation starts kind of warming up to America, the United States feeling like they might have a home here. And we won the war. And if Stalin was bad, yeah, did that mean America was good? In what ways was it good? And then you have the third generation, which includes Podoretz, and really the main other person he mentions in that context is Susan Sontag. But you can tell Podoretz is very keen to the movement of generations, the shifts in the culture, the idea that the distinctions between highbrow and middlebrow were kind of breaking down, and that you could write. He lavishes praise on Warshaw, I forget his first name, who was the movie critic for the commentary, for writing about movies with so much intelligence and learning, and that, the family didn't quite respect him enough for that. But you can just kind of see how Podoretz places himself in this trajectory, yeah, and that he seemed to kind of have absorbed it all and was trying to do something that he thought sort of brought the preoccupations of the family into, like, the full mainstream of American critical life.
Well, and so what's so interesting about that is that the generational theme continues, and we have another 50 years of hindsight on it. And in some cases, I mean, the neocons of our era are kind of famously incestuous. And there's no way I can exhaustively map this, but just to give people a basic idea, Irving Kristol's son, Bill Kristol, is a leading neoconservative intellectual. His mother was Gertrude Himmelfarb, who was also a neoconservative intellectual. Norman Podhoretz's wife was Midge Dechter, also a neoconservative intellectual. His son is John Podhoretz, but also his late daughter, Rachel, was married to Elliot Abrams, the neoconservative policymaker and war criminal.
Who is now advising the Trump administration on their, policy in Latin America.
On how to overthrow Venezuela, which, recalls how he spent the Reagan administration committing genocide in Guatemala, among other things. And, there's other, Bill Kristol's daughter is married to Matthew Continetti. It goes on and on. But basically, the neocons are a family. In almost a literal sense. And so with Irving Kristol and John Podhoretz, with Irving and Bill Kristol, and with Norman and John Podhoretz in particular, I think you can sort of see how this generation follows through. Irving and John, who at the time were, I think, running the Weekly Standard and Commentary, which John just straight up inherited from his father, were major boosters of the Iraq War and of all of the Bush administration's war on terror policies. And, you could argue they were the defining public intellectuals of the early 2000s. And that's where neoconservatism ended up. But what's striking when you go back and read Making It is Israel is barely mentioned. Politics in general is kind of just a backdrop to the literary intellectual world. It's very strange to think that the man who's writing this is going to, 40 years later, be writing a book called, World War IV, where World War III was the Cold War, and now World War IV is the global battle against Islamofascism. You really don't see that coming in anything in Making It, that particular set of fixations.
Yeah. And that's and maybe the what's besides it being like, a fun gossipy memoir to read and to and also like a sort of incredible psychological study of its writer and narrator, whether intentionally or unintentionally on his part. It may be that sort of understanding what happens to him, what his impulses were in writing this thing, what happens to him in the aftermath, and what that has to do with the trajectory of sort of like a conservative mind in America, might be the what's really useful about this book in some ways.
Yeah. Well, and also in a way that's not explicitly political, but it is in a deeper sense. I think this book is also an early forerunner of a major cultural shift that defines not only conservatism, but I would say a lot of just mainstream liberal culture as well. Because the anxiety, I mean, granted, even now reading this grown man who's accomplished other things bragging about his A pluses is inherently comical and ludicrous. But in a way, I think less than it would have been 50 years ago. Because besides Donald Trump constantly bragging about how he's a genius and he's a stable genius and all that, besides having that and that kind of absurd right-wing braggadocio, in the piece I wrote, I compare him to Jay-Z and similar rappers following that kind of like nakedly self-aggrandizing template, or to the Lin-Manuel Miranda version of Hamilton, which is pretty directly rooted in rappers like Jay-Z. This notion that you should be unapologetically proud of striving and getting ahead and of the material rewards for doing so. And another thing I'd cite is George Packer's book in 2013, The Unwinding, which was a kind of, in retrospect, prophetic book about how we got to this point. It has its flaws, but overall, I like it. And that book is full of these little vignettes about very famous people, including Jay-Z and Oprah, as well as right-wing figures like Newt Gingrich, who kind of defined the last half century and who all, regardless of their backgrounds or their ideologies or anything, are sort of implicitly united by just kind of self-promotion and self-absorption.
Well, and their success is part of what defines their celebrity.
Yeah. And I just sort of see in Norman's book this kind of ahead of its time, not in a good way, but yeah, this prescient look at like what if I write a memoir that's just about how great I am and how I made it, and you should worship me because I made it. Like, that's normal now.
It might be worth now pointing to the class dimension a little bit, because I do think he's extremely insightful about the operation of class, and especially when he goes to England. And basically, he moves into his new rooms and a butler shows up, right? Saying he was going to make his fires in the morning and wake him up with tea. And going to England seemed to, that juxtaposition of what he'd experienced in America and what he'd experienced in a society that was more traditionally class-bound, in the traditional sense of class, that was an extremely interesting element of the book. And I think it has to do a little bit with the bragging he does, which is that, these other people, they had it made already. They didn't have to earn it. They didn't have to fight for it. I've earned it. I've fought for it. I'm going to tell you how I did it. Yeah. And I'm not going to pretend that the things that my intelligence and my striving and all these didn't matter, because everyone else tells you that stuff doesn't matter, but they're lying to you. And I'm going to level with you. And I think that does come out of a bit of his class origins and the resentments he kind of builds up along the way. And this gets to owning the libs too, because what he's really doing is pointing out their hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And from the very first, I mean, that's in the first page of the book, really, that identifying that something that's actually true is something that our basically liberal elites don't want to talk about.
I think one of the truly just like the best written and compelling in novelistic parts of the book is the moment where his teacher, Mrs. K, who is his sort of, who treats him as a sort of Pygmalion project. She sort of like has this sort of patrician anti-Semitic quality.
Right, she's like old Brooklyn wasp.
She's his teacher, what, in junior high, basically?
Or high school.
Or early high school,
Who sort of like hates him, but also like takes him under her wing and like wants to make him go plays.
Right. There's also quite a lot of like unspoken like sexual erotic tension in this relationship. We might be able to just give him credit for like alluding to it effectively as a writer without actually saying that it's there. Right. But, you know, there's a lot of things about Norman Podhoretz's oeuvre which suggests that he's not unwilling to like display his pathologies on the page.
For instance, there's a part in the book where he compares writer's block to impotence, and then says that he masturbates before he writes anything.
Well, some writers do, David. Some writers do. Right. Or writers have been known to. Right.
It's not just me, Norman Podhoretz. Yeah. Doesn't everybody do that?
Yeah. I think we should, the sexual stuff, this is a whole dimension we'll tackle later. Sam, finish the story of this teacher.
One of the best sort of scenes and passages in the book is when she takes him to, she wants to buy him an expensive suit so that he can impress the interviewers for his Harvard interview. And his whole experience of realizing, I mean, he has sort of like built himself up as like, I'm loyal to my neighborhood, I'm loyal to my background, to my hardscrabble Jewishness, and he has experienced her intervention as sort of trying to like extricate him from that world and make him into the sort of person who will be able to succeed at Harvard in the higher echelons of society. And he's very resistant to that, and he has the experience of realizing the cruelty of what she is trying to do, especially as it will be experienced by his mother, but also finding himself wanting the suit and how troubling that is to him. It's like the moment where he realizes that he's going to exact this betrayal upon his past and his neighborhood and his family.
Yeah, I think one of the things he gets at really well, and you're pointing to it with the story of his teacher, is he felt very humiliated by her. She would always scream at him, "You filthy slum child," things like that.
Well, she takes him to a fancy French restaurant, right?
A non-kosher restaurant.
Yeah.
So he didn't really know what this food was or feel comfortable eating it. That scene is just spectacular.
Well, it reminded me of what was a thing around the time I read this book. This infamous David Brooks column where he takes his non-college educated friend to a Italian sandwich shop in D.C. and she's like intimidated by the fancy names of everything. And I found the shop. I've been there. It's real. The sandwiches are pretty good.
And I think for me where he went with this was so interesting, because he describes very perceptively and movingly what it means to leave the class you grew up in, and what that means for your relationship with your family, and how there's kind of no good answer to it, yeah. Right? Like he doesn't even judge his family. Like, I think this is a mean book in a lot of ways. He dishes on all kinds of people, and he certainly is critical of his family. But you can see it's very genuine that he, at a certain point, he goes back home and things just aren't the same. He can't unlearn the knowledge he has. Yeah. He can't not see his parents a certain way. And they can't help but feel almost looked down upon by him. But I think the relationship with his teacher also is interesting, because you can see the dynamic whereby the very thing he wants, to be accepted by a different class of people, to move up in the world in a certain way, is also the thing that kind of brings humiliation and shame and feelings of anxiety over his family. And that bind is there throughout the whole book. The very people he wants to impress, he also kind of hates, yes, or has some antagonistic relationship with.
An interesting thing about the teacher, well, two interesting things. First, that he doesn't note, but that seems like, in hindsight, really obvious about all this. One is that although she's like an old Brooklyn WASP, she's a woman in an era where there's only so far women can go professionally. So in a way, by raising this, you know, slum Jewish boy who on one level she resents, she's also, because he's a man and because this is a time of upward mobility for white men in America, she's giving him a chance to go further than she probably would have been able to. And that's a dynamic he doesn't examine, but it's there. And what he does mention in passing, which is an incredibly telling aside, especially in light of his later career, is he says, and then does not say anything else about it, that she never took much interest in what he says are the Negro children in the class. So he is casually copping to white privilege here. He's saying, look, like, I was in this class of like poor Jewish boys and poor black boys. And I mean, there were presumably girls too, but and my WASPy teacher, even though she probably hated all of us, she took an interest in me. And she launched my career where I made it. But somehow, although he tells the story and it's clearly important to him, he doesn't like take the humility that I think a left-leaning person might take today and say, I was lucky. I was lucky that I was white enough in that sense. I was lucky that she focused on me. I was, you know, I owe my success to forces beyond my own brilliance and intellect. No, in his version, that's a very minor detail, but still worth mentioning that she didn't help the black kids, but she helped him. But the kind of implication is more that because he was smarter than them. And I mean, if he's saying anything at all about it, he's saying that. And I don't think that's an unfair inference to draw in light of, yeah, maybe the most famous thing Podhoretz ever wrote other than Making It, or maybe more than Making It, which is his essay, My Negro Problem and Ours, which, Sam, why don't you explain what that's all about?
Oh, great.
Well, I know you were just rereading it. So
that essay was 1963?
Right. So a couple years before Making It. It's referenced in the book.
In commentary?
Yes.
And basically it's him trying to make sense of the problem of race hatred and his own, and based on his own experiences of growing up in a working class neighborhood that was both Jewish, Italian, and black in Brownsville. And his sort of strategy is to be very forthright about the fact that he hates, desires, fears, is excited by black people, black men. He knows that, like, you know, his experience growing up was that there was a clear race divide amongst the children. When he was very young, everybody, the race wasn't as obvious. But once he got to be junior high school, the friend groups were divided along race, and there was like sort of turf wars over like the baseball field and all this stuff. There was fights and violence and blah, blah, blah. And of course, like, there's so much racism in this essay, of course. Like, there's so much casual depictions of black people as an undifferentiated mass. But it's interesting to think about that essay in relation to Making It, because it's kind of the same gambit. What he's trying to do is say, all white people, even woke liberals.
And there were woke liberals in the early 60s.
Right, all white people, enlightened liberals and elites among them, also feel this way, right? In Making It, he's saying everybody's actually ambitious and out for themselves. And in My Negro Problem and Ours, he's saying all white people are racist. And the question is, how do we deal with this problem? And in an interesting way, it seems like he succeeds in that essay in a way that he doesn't in the book, because it's a famous essay. It was very controversial and blah, blah, blah. And the place that he lands ultimately is the solution is miscegenation, in effect.
Yeah. He basically takes the classic question, you know, would you let your daughter marry one? And he says, well, I hate the idea, but yes, I would. And in fact, like, the way we'll solve this problem is we'll all interbreed and we'll all be mixed, and then we won't hate each other anymore.
And so, of course, like, the ideology undergirding, like, so much of that essay, the pathologies on display are despicable, and they are a product of his, you know, deeply felt white supremacy. Even when he's praising black people, he praises them in sort of like sexualized, exotified terms. You know, he's jealous of the grace, the comfort with the body that the black men embody for him, their athleticism and obviously their sexual prowess, which he imagines is, you know, uniform. But it's a good essay. I mean, I don't know the last time you guys read it. It's in the sense that it is, by displaying his pathologies with so unapologetically and sort of saying, this is how it is. This is how I am. And of course, he assumes all white people are that way, which is his want, is always to assume that everyone experiences the world exactly the way he does. But by doing that, he creates a problem for him to solve in the essay, which is a challenge. Like, it's you know, it doesn't avoid the problem, doesn't avoid the question of racism, which is a fundamental fact. I guess I just felt reading it like it's so much more honest than like so what especially like conservatives will write about race at this point, which is that they will never acknowledge that they're actually racist, and that the problem might be, how do I solve the problem that I'm racist? And that's his starting point, is I'm racist, how do I solve the problem that I'm racist?
Well, and we should just briefly say, because he explains it in Making It, where this essay came from, because it's actually delicious where this essay came from. He was friends or frenemies or something with James Baldwin.
Well, he wrote a commentary, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Actually, the origin of the story is Baldwin was supposed to write an article. I think it was about Black Islam or like Nation of Islam, yes, or something like that, for Podhoretz. He had said he would, and then for commentary, and then he took it and wrote it for the New Yorker instead. Which, you know, we're all writers and editors and such here, is, you know, kind of a dick move, but also like, why wouldn't you? They paid a lot more, as Podhoretz explicitly says in the book. It's, you know, it's just a bigger deal magazine. So Baldwin did that, and Podhoretz felt personally affronted by this. He was furious, and in his reaction, he kind of, you know, chewed Baldwin out and said all kinds of mean things to him, including essentially that he was an ungrateful Black man or some version of that. And he gave this whole rant about, in which he exposed all his racist pathologies. And then Baldwin looks at him and kind of mischievously says, "You should write all of that down." And then Podhoretz did in commentary. And that's how we got this Our Negro Problem essay. And I want to believe that Baldwin was on one level was just like, this guy's a jackass and I'm going to, you know, set him up. I'm going to give him enough rope to hang himself. And on one level, that's right. But on another level, I think it's what Sam is saying, that Baldwin understood that actually in a weird, sick way, Podhoretz was being more honest about race in America than most white people ever were. And he appreciated it.
Yeah. And just to be clear, this essay that Baldwin had promised to Podhoretz, a commentary that ended up being published in The New Yorker, was The Fire Next Time.
Yes,
right?
Good
so,
point.
So we're not talking about, I mean, as an editor, I would be, you know, a little disappointed at least if I had had a chance to publish The Fire Next Time and, you know, another publication ended up with it. But the honesty, what do you make of Podhoretz's honesty in this essay? Because it, as Sam pointed out, he's admitting these racist attitudes, but he doesn't shy away from describing them as racist attitudes, right? He kind of admits they're not necessarily good things about himself. And I wonder too if this goes back to his nose for hypocrisy, because in a way what he's really saying is all the goody-two-shoe liberals who aren't as honest as I am, they feel this way too, and I'm going to be the one to admit it. But otherwise, you have a lot of conservative tropes in this essay.
Yes,
one being the black-on-white crime argument, right? Like, look, these people aren't so innocent either.
And he says, like, you know, I was told that blacks were worse off in America than Jews, but I never had that experience.
Right. Yeah, so it's almost...
He was the oppressed one. He says Jews were oppressed by black people, by which he means they bullied him on the playground.
Yeah, so you have that kind of strain of contemporary arguing on the right, which is, again, the mix of like black people committing crimes against white people. Oh, I'm not that privileged either. All that stuff.
And he's clearly so much more offended by black anti-Semitism than white anti-Semitism.
But also, I mean, oppression to him is black kids beating him up on the playground. It's not the fact that he gets to go to Columbia and they don't.
Right.
Which, you know, means that he gets to make it and they don't.
It seems to me that when you're thinking about neoconservatism and the shift among Jewish intellectuals to the right, kind of like urban race issues are important to that.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? And we mentioned that Podhoretz is more literary, but a lot of early neoconservatism, the first wave, before foreign policy becomes such a central preoccupation of the neoconservatives, a lot of them are social scientists and sociologists who, because they had this background growing up in cities seemed very attuned to, say, the quote-unquote urban problems that the Great Society was trying to address. And the whole strain of the neoconservative critique of the welfare state kind of comes out of their being there for that, growing up the way they did, having the tools of social science, and then kind of taking maybe some of the instincts that Podoritz puts on particular display and finding, I shouldn't say finding, that might be too cynical, but again, through the lens of social science, saying why this program to alleviate poverty actually was creating dependency.
Dependency and moral, you know, depravity.
I would say the single most famous thing Irving Kristol ever said, his most famous quip, was that a conservative is a liberal who, or maybe a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality.
No, and, just mugged.
Yeah, or just mugged.
Yeah,
right. And he and you know, I think everyone understood the gist of what he was saying at the time. Honestly, if you want to see a repository for the kind of core of early neoconservatism, if you've ever read a report or anything bylined by someone from the Manhattan Institute, which is basically a conservative think tank in New York City that is, I don't know exactly who founded it when or anything, but it's basically an outgrowth of that set of neoconservatism and is, you know, in the same way that like... the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute might have explained the George W. Bush administration and kind of its core thought process. The Manhattan Institute was basically that for Rudy Giuliani and Michael Bloomberg's
yes.
Mayoralties, which, you know, 20 years that completely changed New York City and were basically about neoliberalism, encouraging gentrification, and aggressive policing against black and brown communities and stop and frisk. Mm-hmm. And, Giuliani himself, of course, today is a figure of pure resentment, deeply implicated in Trumpism, which suggests how logically these kind of high-minded justifications for racist policing, anti-welfare state, all of that, you know, transition seamlessly in the end to Trump's just kind of naked bigotry
yeah.
and race baiting.
It's all there, yeah. It really is like this book. You could see like a clear trajectory from making it to Donald Trump. Outer Borough, Stryver. I mean, of course, he was born rich and his success is due entirely to his father. So there's nothing like that. But the story that he tries to tell, the mythology of Trump is safe, self-made. And he's so New York.
Well, and constantly trying to impress the Manhattan elite, right?
Right. And so that's the other thing. It's like the resentments, Trump so much, I mean, people do talk about this, but it's I think it's more explanatory than we give it credit. Trump's anger that he was never fully accepted by Manhattan elite, the Manhattan elite world, especially of the arts and literature, like drove him crazy, drove him insane. Like it made him so angry. And like, although he wasn't a conservative necessarily at the time, we can also see his like, transition into the ultimate trigger, the libs president, as like, I'm gonna get back at these people. And when he thinks of these people, like the libs in his imaginations, it's rich New York liberals. Right. And he hates them because they didn't accept him because he was too vulgar, too Queens, too, you know, like that's the sort of,
you know,
idea
if,
there.
If you follow Trump carefully, I mean, like his background and the, you know, if you're a serious Trump scholar, what you learn is that, you know, all the time he'll tweet like the lying New York Times, which is failing. But like the truth is he reads it every day. Yeah. Why does Maggie Haberman get scoops? Because, I mean, first of all, because she covered him at the New York Post as a tabloid reporter, but also because like when the New York Times calls, he answers. Yeah. Because Donald Trump, no matter how much he's trolled the libs, no matter how much he's embarrassed them, you know, no matter that he's the literal president of the United States, he still like desperately wants the New York Times to write nice things about him. And on occasion when they have, when for instance, their op-ed editor, James Bennett, published somebody saying that Democrats owe Trump an apology for the Russiagate scandal, this yeah. ludicrous column, Trump will tweet and say, finally, something good in the New York Times about yeah. me. And like, you know, because he wants it. he really wants that approval.
Yeah, right. And like we know, like he ends up like embracing the fashion world because it's sort of the most vulgar high art, basically. But the other thing is the idea of the valorization of success. Like Trump is saying is the apotheosis of like Podoritz's thesis, which is that actually success is to be valorized. It's to be celebrated. And like Trump's living his life, his gilded apartment, the idea that someone who lives so ostentatiously in luxury and wealth could be a figure of populist fervor, and that he is in not, it's that it's not a contradiction that he is this extraordinary wealthy, ostentatiously luxurious person, a person who like wallows in his fame and riches, that it's not a contradiction that he should be a populist figure, is kind of exactly the thesis that Podoritz is putting forward. The truthful, honest, working class message is that celebrate your success. You have it. You've gotten it. You've worked hard for it.
People talk about how Trump is an aspirational figure, how he's a working class person's idea of what being successful would look like, right? Like if you know the world of New York wealth, you know that like, you know, typically it's like, or the real ideal, the kind of highbrow ideal, is kind of multi-generational wealth in like a tasteful apartment full of books and art.
Yeah, but if you were to ask how much is that art, you know, the art on the wall that's just tastefully there and it's not making a big attention to itself, but it's like $50,000.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to ask. You're supposed to just accept the kind of like the taste and the glamour and go along with it. And it's a world that, and this is a difference between Norman Podhoretz and Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a vulgar simpleton and could never have, no matter how rich he was, how influential he was, there's just no way he could go to one of these, you know, Upper West Side dinner parties and be taken seriously. Podhoretz could have. He had a shot. He was being taken seriously. But the chip on his shoulder was so great that with this book, he threw it all out and embraced the right. But, you know, he actually was educated and learned, and having come from a working class background, he actually did work really, really hard to get where he was.
Well, it's sort of like Trump is the precipitate of this process that Podoritz is sort of describing. Like he is the version of it that exists without any of the high art aspirations or the actual kind of like aesthetic and moral seriousness that Podoritz is at least adopting as his outfit, his clothing at this point in his life in the 60s.
Right.
Trump is like what happens when you take this thesis to its extreme.
One other thing, and I think this gets to the central hypocrisy of this whole worldview, one thing that Podhoretz and Trump do have in common is they both have fail sons.
There was a tablet interview with Podoritz from 2019 by Lee Smith,
who also blurbs the NYRB edition.
Yes, I'm sure he does.
and whose book was recently promoted by Donald Trump
on Twitter. Yeah. So Podoritz says he doesn't quite understand why New Yorkers don't recognize Trump as clearly one of their own. And this is the quote. "If you've known New York real estate people like I have," he said, "he's a paradigmatic example. I never met Trump, but I know a lot of people in that business, so I know what it's like to succeed as a New York real estate Nick. I told him," this is Lee Smith, "that I'd never heard that phrase before, real estate Nick." Podoritz says, "Oh yeah, it's very common actually. You know, people say jokingly Trump is Jewish. He's not literally, but if you're a real estate guy in New York, you're sort of automatically Jewish. Why then," this is Lee Smith again, "do so many Jewish conservatives, including members of the neoconservative movement that Podoritz led, dislike Trump?" And Norman says, "I think the deepest reason was that a lot of people on the right, not just neoconservatives, saw him as a new McCarthy test. They thought that Bill Buckley had made a great mistake in supporting McCarthy, as he later admitted. So Trump was a sort of moral political test of how you define the limits of conservative respectability. And therefore, it was absolutely crucial to take the right stand." Which I think in the context of, you know, things we've talked about in the podcast is really interesting, insightful. Like that the problem with McCarthy for conservatives was not what his project was, but that he was too vulgar and too unapologetic and too populist. And what Podoretz is saying here is that Trump is the same thing. The problem for the neocons was not that what Trump wanted to do certainly wasn't his racism or his, what ultimately his plutocratic policy positions. It was that he was a vulgar man.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I also think for a lot of neocon or neoconish people, there's a perception, one that I share and would take further than they have, that Trump is a fascist, which, you know, and a sort of natural anti-Semite, which was, you know, also something one could have said about McCarthy at the time, and many did. And we're actually saying this, I think, the day after Trump gave a speech to the Israeli American Council. So this is a right-wing Zionist, you know, mostly Jewish organization. So he's addressing a group of Jewish conservatives, and he says, "You're not nice people at all, but you have to vote for me. You have no choice. You're not going to vote for Pocahontas, I can tell you that. You're not going to vote for the wealth tax." So here's Donald Trump addressing...
Why would that be?
and then they applaud him, actually, if you watch the video. So here's Donald Trump addressing a group of Jewish conservatives, of enthusiastic pro-Trump Jewish conservatives, and telling them, essentially, you're a bunch of shifty, avaricious Jews who don't want your wealth taxed, and that's why you're not going to vote for Elizabeth Warren, who he also refers to by a racial slur. And they love it. And so these are the Jews who do like Donald Trump, but there's, you know, 75% or so of American Jews are liberal or left-wing and would never vote for Trump. But at the margin between them and the quarter who do like him and who don't like this, who don't find this anti-Semitic or who think it's philo-Semitic and appreciate it or whatever it is, at the margin between them, there's a number of neoconservative intellectuals who recognize that this is an anti-Semite and that this kind of populism is just inherently bad for the Jews. But at the same time...
Or nationalism. Nationalism is bad for the Jews.
Yeah. But at the same time, agree with him on a lot of things, like moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah, I kind of have my take on that kind of thing. I mean, obviously, it's absurd, right? Of course, the obvious thing, I'm sure lots of people are tweeting about this, like that conservatives go crazy when Ilhan Omar criticizes Israel, but no one will criticize Trump for just obviously peddling in classic anti-Semitic caricatures. But I see this also as just sort of, whenever he sort of like makes one of these wink, wink, nudge, nudge jokes about like Jews and money, is that he thinks he's Jewish. Like he thinks he's in the tribe. You know, he was surrounded by Jews in his career, and I'm sure he made these jokes. And honestly, like, you know, when somebody makes that joke and it's somebody that I trust, like I laugh. You know, like he thinks he's Jewish, and he seems Jewish.
I mean, his daughter converted, his son-in-law is Jewish, he has many Jewish friends and advisors.
The important fact here is that structurally, he has enabled, encouraged, and authorized anti-Jewish violence in the world.
Most notably when he praised the Charlottesville marchers.
He has been, you know, consistently unwilling to actually disown his Nazi supporters, right? So that's the important thing. But on the level of like psychology and pop psychology, sort of like just Trumpology, I think so much of what explains this attitude and actually kind of his whole manner is that he thinks he's Jewish.
Yeah. And he's made jokes before, like, oh, like about who his accountants are. Like, oh, you know, like the guys I want counting my shekels are, you know, like he describes their appearance even.
Which is legitimately funny if you're not the president who has, you know, hired Stephen Miller to do, you know, your immigration policy, right? But, I don't know if I should trot out this theory on the podcast because I should write it for Jewish Currents. But I think if you watch Trump give speeches, his performance is the performance of a Borscht Belt comedian. It's actually striking. Like if you watch like Mel Brooks give interviews on late night shows and then you watch Trump, like the cadence, the way that he like tells a story and then interrupts the story to say something else. Like, it's clear that he watched a lot of television, watched Jewish comedians perform, and that was his idea of how you win over an audience. The great undermining irony of it is that what Mel Brooks does when he like interrupts himself is self-effacing, right? It's Jewish comedy. It's undermining himself, making fun of himself. Trump is incapable of doing that. So he interrupts himself to say something else good about himself. And so it's not funny and it's not Jewish. But the form of it is fundamentally Jewish comedy. We may cut this from the podcast.
Well, this is my theory. I would love it if you wrote that for us. But, you know, I'll say that, Trump is clearly, he's not Jewish and he is an anti-Semite among the many other things he is. But he's not, I don't think, a conscious anti-Semite. And he unquestionably has been around Jews his whole life. And I think more germane than is, you know, what's in Trump's soul is just the stark reality that a large minority of Jews in America, and I think a majority of Jews in Israel, really like this guy. Yeah. And think he's on their side. And in a sense, they're right. I mean, if to you the major battle is between Israel and Iran and global, you know, Islamofascism, not my term, but then I think Donald Trump is on your side. If on the other hand your concept of what it means to be good for the Jews is one about pluralism and social justice and things like that, then obviously
cosmopolitanism,
then it's obviously a completely different story. But, you know, Podhoretz, I'm sure he recognizes that kind of Borscht Belt shtick from how he and his buddies would hang out in high school and play stickball or whatever. And I do actually want to briefly note, there is, of course, another Jew about a decade younger than Podhoretz who also grew up in outer Brooklyn and was the son of a working class immigrant and went to a good college and made it and shows that this is not the only way to do that. And his name is Bernie Sanders. And he's, he's coming from a very similar place, but he drew different lessons. And the reason I wanted to talk about the fail son earlier, about John Podhoretz, Norman's frankly awful son, who, if you know, you've ever encountered him on Twitter or National Review or commentary or whatever, is just a terribly unpleasant guy. And I will generously call him an intellectual mediocrity.
That is a generosity.
Yeah.
He really is the, you know, conservatism as, gesture, as a...
A bunch of irritable mental gestures. Yeah,
I mean, was actually Lionel Trilling, Norman's teacher at Columbia and one-time mentor. Yes.
Yeah. So John, to me, the existence of John, if we can just all stipulate that John Podhoretz sucks and he has nothing interesting to say and he's just
we won't be doing an episode on John.
But I think it's worth bringing up John since he is technically a public intellectual and runs the journal that his father ran for many years, that the existence of this kind of nothing who nepotistically, who, you know, went to, grew up on the Upper West Side, went to good schools, and nepotistically inherited his father's magazine, shows the meaninglessness of this kind of striver narrative, like, and the inability of conservatives, but also a fair number of centrists and liberals, to think structurally. Like, it's great that Norman Podhoretz made it. Congratulations to him. He worked hard. He overcame obstacles. He clearly had some talent and intellect. And we can give him that, whatever other criticisms we might have of him. But in the end, what it amounts to is he raises a son on the Upper West Side in exactly the same kind of privileged bubble that he finds himself resenting on his way up. And then he hands that son the same power he had, which his son clearly never earned.
And has not a modicum of the talent or intellect that the father.
Yeah, and to me, what that says is that, you know, I don't want to begrudge anyone their self-made success, but I think that when we focus on that, on that as being an inherently virtuous thing, you know, we're leaving out any ideological content. And what is it? I mean, to the extent there is an ideology there, the ideology is that most poor and working class people deserve to stay where they are because they just haven't tried hard
enough.
They're
not the talented 10th. Yeah. But I think the question is, what lessons do you take away from that experience? And I feel like something we do talk about on the podcast a lot is like growing up working class or poor and succeeding, you can come away from it with the conclusions that I'm extraordinary and I'm the only extraordinary one. And the reason I've had my success is because I'm extraordinary, or other lessons.
Yeah. I mean, it can either induce pride or humility in a way. And even just reading Making It, look at all the contingent things in his life that allowed him to succeed. He had a teacher who took an interest in him, however flawed she was. He got into Columbia. He, at a time when...
We got the one scholarship, right?
Right. You know, right.
He was also a white guy.
A white guy, right. But even the mentors that nurtured him along the way, and, you know, all these things that if he had been in a slightly different place at a slightly different time might not have broke his way. I mean, when I look back on my own life, those are the things that stand out to me, the contingency of it all, and how I was helped by so many people who didn't have to help me, who were generous to me. But I want to get back to the book a little bit. We've been talking a lot about the continuities between Podoretz and Trump and kind of the preoccupations of Podoretz and other neoconservatives of that era and how they seem to still be with us in some ways. But I want to talk about the discontinuities. And this is going to be me nerding out a little bit about some of the stuff that I really am preoccupied with. But looking at the milieu in which he existed in the 1950s and early 60s in New York, it's striking how far away that world seems in some ways. Now, I know being writers and editors in New York, there's resonances.
Yeah, we get into fistfights about reviews of books that we've done.
But it seems to me that like this world of where these intellectuals in New York really thought they were the center of the world in a way, even if they were writing for a publication like Partisan Review, which he admits topped out at like 7,000 or 8,000 subscribers, right? And so for me, one of the pleasures of the book is his recreation of this very heady moment in New York that really only existed in one sense for 10 or 15 years and included people like Norman Mailer, Hannah Arendt, Irving Kristol, James Baldwin, Dwight MacDonald, Susan Sontag, all these intellectuals that a lot of us look back to and think, even if we might prefer some over others, but we acknowledge this, the intellectual life had a place or existed in a certain kind of way that doesn't seem to now. And one of the things that I loved about the book and that I think explains something about Podoretz's trajectory is he emphasizes, and I mentioned previously, that he was the third generation of the family of this group of intellectuals. And one of the things he gets at is that the ground had shifted under his feet. And he almost speaks of it as if, or writes of it as if, there weren't enough great novels for him to truly make it as the kind of towering critic that a T.S. Eliot might have been, or even someone a generation before him, Lionel Trilling, was. And so that's kind of why he turns to politics, right? Like he says, the literary life in America, the novels that were being produced, if you really had stringent taste, you were just going to pan them all. Yeah. But no one likes someone who only writes negative reviews.
Yeah.
And that the culture was changing and, you know, images were becoming more important than the written word. You know, movies were important. Films were important. Popular culture was being looked at a different way. And he kind of, again, explains his turn to politics and some of those people around him as being a product of, okay, this literary culture existed. That was what I wanted to be a part of. But by the time I really made it, it was, in fact, basically over. I didn't know it at the time, but it was basically over.
The sociological phenomenon that you were describing, where there was this moment where, like, he could write in this book that literary criticism was the place where real thinking was being done. Like, that was a short moment. And it is a heady, incredible thing to think about. I don't know, something that was funny to me in the in that New York Times profile of him from... 2017, where he says, you know, this is sort of the attitude you're describing, but it's still his attitude now. This is from the article. As for the intellectual world that nourished him, he said, it was a product of another time. And here's Norman. Nobody cares that much anymore. We really cared. Art had become a kind of religion. I mean, a substitute for religion. And works of art were sacred objects. A great work of art had to be revered. Susan Sontag went and spent a whole night sitting at the tomb of George Balanchine. Think about that for a minute. It's like going to a saint. And Susan was one of the worst. Worst in the sense that she was one of the worshippers of art. I guess there are still people who argue about, is David Foster Wallace a great writer? Which he isn't. I don't know. But the thing is, like, that's also revealing. This is 2017. What are book critics are not arguing about whether David Foster Wallace is a great writer. Like, there are still debates. I guess what I think about is, like, everyone always experiences, like, the fall of the higher pursuit of their profession during their lifetime. You know, like, Christian Lorentzen just wrote his, like, 6,000-word thing in Harper's about how, like, book criticism is done because of, like, the commercialization of book criticism, and it's all just lists of what you should read and pictures of people on Instagram reading books. And it's like, I was sympathetic to that piece in many ways, but it also just felt like this same kind of thing. Like, ugh, we used to actually do criticism, and now we don't do it anymore. And we used to be serious, and the younger people aren't.
Is there any point in the book where, for all his, you know, acuity about class and stuff, is there any point in the book where he's scared? I mean, and not just scared of disapproval or of social rejection, but, like, scared that he might end up being a milkman back in Brownsville? I don't think there is. Is there? Like, he's pretty confident from at least the moment he goes to Columbia. You know, he might rise and fall in the social scene. He might, you know, make, you know, have falling outs or make enemies or whatever. But he's never, like, actually worried that, you know, his student loan debt is going to overwhelm him. He's going to be just financially rejected from Manhattan entirely. And which honestly is an anxiety that I think the vast majority of writers, not just who come from working class backgrounds, but from middle and upper middle class backgrounds. Yeah. Everyone should donate to this podcast. Everyone should subscribe to Jewish Currents. But no, like, I hardly know a single writer who's not anxious about that. And it doesn't seem to cross his mind, even though he's genuinely a product of the working class.
Yeah, and it should be stated just that also one of the facts of that moment in the history of American letters, so to speak, is, like, of course, yeah, okay, James Baldwin is allowed to be in the scene, but almost no other black writers are even mentioned in this book. And, you know, Mary McCarthy gets mentioned as a brilliant critic, also quite pretty. And, like, that's kind of the ad. Oh, right. Oh, and Sontag's success owes to a significant degree in Norman's judgment to her looks. So that's also a fact of this moment, which was, like, it was high times for white men, but not so much everyone else.
Well, and I would also say, and this is not just true in the intelligentsia, but really across all of American society, the post-war decades are a period when working-class white ethnics, Jews, Italians, Poles, etc., Irish, are experiencing just dramatic upward mobility. And if you're a talented person of this generation, and you're a working class non-WASP, you really could make it. And you would feel like there was a justice in your making it, because A, you are talented and you're being rewarded for your talents, and you're, like, the first generation to do so. And B, you know, doing so is kind of inherently subversive of the WASP establishment, right? That's something you can be proud of. Naturally, you're not going to think about all the people shut out, women, people of color, people of your background who didn't make it. You know, you're not going to think about the structural factors that made this particular transfer of wealth and status in mid-20th century America precisely to people like Norman Podhoretz possible. We can, with the benefit of hindsight, see that clearly.
Yeah, well, there's actually a really interesting comment he makes where he said, even though it's a bit of an unfair stereotype, because there was this sense of shared prosperity, at least among whites, and that the white ethnics were kind of rising, politics became more subdued, or there was a more of a general agreement, and that's why partly why literary criticism flourished too. Like when politics recedes, literature rose to the fore. But then with he name checked specifically the civil rights movement and then protests over the Vietnam War, like that jump started politics again. People realized that things weren't as solid as they might have seemed, and that's partly why some of the members of the family turned more towards writing about politics, including himself in some ways. One of the really interesting pieces written about Podoretz was by Benjamin Moser, who is famous right now for his biography of Susan Sontag that just came out.
He also wrote a wonderful biography of Clarice Lispector.
Yes. And as it turns out, it was Moser who kind of wanted the New York Review of Books to publish this new edition of the book for its 50th anniversary. And he had been commissioned to write the introduction to it. You know, a lot of these New York Review of Books editions have some kind of introduction by a contemporary scholar, or writer who looks back at the importance of the book, etc. But that plan was nixed. Sam, do you want to tell us a little bit about what happened?
Well, yeah, what's interesting is that I guess Moser went to interview Podoretz for the Sontag biography, and he went to his home and he was impressed by him. You know, he was like, this is a, you know, this person does have a great intelligence, and his, you know, he talks about how his apartment is full of the same books you would expect to see in any kind of left-wing intellectual of his generation. But he also observed a thing that, so Moser begins his piece writing about the experience of writing the introduction and then having, well, Podoretz nix it, say, right, you know, somebody else has to write this. He begins his piece by saying that it was the piece that he wrote about Norman was the first piece where he was not honest, where he lied. And the thing that he lied about, he says, the central thing that he didn't include in the piece that he thinks actually is the key to understanding this personality is that he observed when they met in his apartment this rage, which he identified as the rage that is endemic to alcoholism, like an alcoholic rage. And, you know, I guess that's like a touchy subject to talk about. But it's also the case, we know from his own account, that in the aftermath of making it coming out and being so widely panned by precisely the people that he had spent his whole career ingratiating himself to, that he sort of went on a bender of some, you know, maybe years.
Well, then he sobered up, right? Because he told Moser that he hadn't had a drink in 40 years.
Right.
And in another great essay about this book by Louis Menon, the New Yorker critic, he describes this intense mystical spiritual experience Podoretz claims to have had that was tied up with getting sober.
Podoretz describing an experience he had in the early spring of 1970. He said he was walking outside, carrying a martini, and feeling content when it happened. And there's the quote. I saw physically in the sky, though it was obviously in my head, a kind of diagram that resembled a family tree. And it was instantly clear to me that this diagram contained the secret of life and existence and knowledge. That you start with this and you follow to that, it all had a logic of interconnectedness. And he sort of distills the essence of this experience to the realization that, quote, Judaism was true. And Menon says, he did not mean the ethical teachings of Judaism. He meant Judaic law, and he vowed to change his life. That was 1970.
What's interesting about this is, I don't think I'd read that before we started talking today, and I've thought about Podhoretz for a long time. I don't think of him as a practicing or Orthodox Jew. I mean, he's unmistakably a Jew, and later in his career he becomes very vocally Zionist, like many of the neocons. But this notion of a spiritual awakening, it's not something he like wears on his sleeve. I mean, to be a modern Republican in the last several decades involves making common cause with the religious right, but especially in the intellectual wing, that generally doesn't describe how they live their lives. And this seems much more germane to the fact that he stopped drinking. And also that he rejected liberalism and would reject it from that point on. The thing that's really interesting about this Moser piece, so Moser wrote an introduction, which Podhoretz rejected. And you can read the whole introduction along with an introduction to it of about the same length by Moser, in which he says he lied. And Moser, he not only attributes a lot of Podhoretz's persona to alcoholism, he also says something that's incredibly morally clear that I've often thought, but that strikes me that liberal intellectuals of an older generation have a lot of trouble with, which is he says that a kind of cardinal rule for him in life and sort of central to his type of liberalism has been trying to understand people who are different and trying not to judge. And that includes people who are intellectual and ideological adversaries like Podhoretz, you know, that instead of that you should be compassionate and try to understand how they see things. And that the truth is, watching this kind of dry drunk, you know, present himself, he came away thinking, you know what, this isn't just like a funny fascination. And in a way, he regrets that he was trying to, I guess we would use the term platform, his 50-year-old memoir. Like, the reality is, this guy is bad, and his insights are terrible insights. And we were saying before we recorded this, Podhoretz is, none of his political ideology, none of the positions he takes or the arguments he makes for them, none of it is sophisticated at all. It's stuff that any kind of TPUSA, you know, conservative hack could come up with. We're interested in Podhoretz because of who he was before he started saying that stuff.
Let me read just from the Moser for a second. You know, he says, like you're saying, you know, we smile politely and hear people out and never interrupt and try not to judge. This is the, like, liberal catechism that he's learned. And he said, it's not just financial security that allows us this view. We derive our idea of tolerance ultimately from literature, from those books on Podhoretz's shelves. Literature awakens empathy and allows us to see people, especially people unlike ourselves as individuals. So we listen and don't interrupt, unlike some people on the podcast. But Moser said, this could go too far. It was one thing to listen or attribute anger to an ugly disease. But why was I, a gay man, trying to make nice with someone who had opposed spending on AIDS research because it would allow gay men to, quote, resume buggering each other with complete medical impunity? He literally wanted me to die.
Yeah, so, I mean, to my mind, this is the insight of today's righteous young progressive and the tradition I try to associate with myself. And it's in an interesting tension with the project of your guys' podcast, which I very much admire. You guys believe in understanding that we need to understand the right, and so do I. But understanding the right should not mean excusing the right, and it should not mean humbling ourselves before the right. And this is a really important distinction to draw, because there's a kind of commonplace in liberal society, and you see it in, you know, the New York Times op-ed page and The Atlantic and places like that all the time, where, you know, well-meaning liberals are sort of embarrassed by how they keep losing to the right. And so they figure the right must have some insight into the human condition that they've been too quick to judge. And so they end up empathizing with it, giving it a platform, giving it more respect than it deserves. And what I admired so much about Moser here is that the three of us are fascinated by Podhoretz and other right-wing figures too, and so is Moser, but he doesn't, you know, he's able to look at that and say, this guy, at the end of the day, he's still a huge asshole. And the things he's saying are not things that we should respect. It's really interesting to sort of psychoanalyze how he got there and what that represents about the right. But let's not mistake that for liking him or for thinking that, like, the core insights of the left are wrong.
I think especially people like Podhoretz and other neoconservatives, part of the reason they maybe garnered the empathy they did, or the reason they were taken seriously, is because they had started out more on the left, were part of this liberal intellectual milieu in New York City. But when you think about it, when you consider neoconservatism, like, it's not just something that happened on the right. And at a certain point, these Jewish intellectuals moved right and maybe gave the right wing some extra firepower. There was a few more publications in the right wing orbit. They were taken extremely seriously, especially the kinds of neoconservatives who wrote for the public interest, Irving Kristol's journal. And you could see the entire political spectrum kind of move right, right? Like there's a way in which the New Republic in the 80s and early 90s was maybe not neoconservative exactly, but...
Well, neoliberal.
Yes, they're kind of the left flank of the same tendency in a way. They didn't go as far as Podoretz or Irving Kristol, but they shifted. And I think that's one reason why the neoconservatives are such an interesting group to think about, is because they seem representative to me of quite a bit in American life. There's a generational story, not just of Jewish intellectuals and Jewish people more broadly, but basically immigrants who became further assimilated into society at a point in time when there was maybe more upward mobility than we have now, when the flush of post-war prosperity allowed different groups to, you know, and join the mainstream and achieve a measure of success and prosperity and financial stability. And when that happened, these people moved right. I mean, this is kind of one of the big stories of American politics in the last, you know, since the post-war era, is a broader prosperity. And then once that's achieved, okay, we're going to make sure we get our own. And the kinds of policies that allowed us to succeed, or the kind of shared prosperity that we admired, you know, the backs were turned on that. Yeah. Basically, the neoconservatives were not so much an opportunistic lagging indicator, but a leading indicator of where lots of people were heading. And it's a generational story. It's partly a story of ethnicity in America, kind of becoming white in a way. And so there's just a lot to consider when you read someone like Podoretz and his fellow travelers.
Yeah. I often think when I think about this trajectory that I'm grateful that Jews still, what's the percentage that are Democrats?
Three quarters.
Because, or like in my heart, I fear that wouldn't still be the case. And that the reasons for that are interesting and complicated, and maybe for another whole podcast about Judaism and conservatism. But I do think that, like, when we talk about this generational story, I think that this is a sort of anachronistic view, or an anachronistic kind of perspective of mine now, although I think that Jewish Currents represents this perspective in an admirable way, is like part of what it is to be Jewish is to be not nationalistic. For me, like my secular Jewish ethical politics is to a significant degree knowing that in every moment in which nationalism has reared its head in a country, Jews have suffered. And so, you know, the caricature, which is also based in reality, that like Jews were very overrepresented in the American Communist Party, like that internationalism is a first principle of like Jewish politics. And that was obviously very much the case for the first generation of the family in Norman's terms. And that as Jews were sort of welcomed into the concept of Americanism and American whiteness in particular, the possibility of embracing America became a possibility. It was open. That became an open possibility. And for me, like so much of what I identify with of like American Judaism in the 20th century is the idea that like we should always be suspicious of national attachments. We should always be worried when somebody starts to define who counts as an American and what the nation, what the national community should be defined as.
First of all, everything Sam just said about Jewish identity is stuff that I don't want to speak for them, but I think broadly the Jewish Currents community and staff feel, you know, not that there's something intrinsically Jewish about being internationalist or progressive or whatever, but that there is a rich left-wing Jewish tradition that we try to uphold, and that we express our own Jewishness largely through those values, which I think is a common feeling for many American Jews. But there's also other traditions, and the Jewish right is a source of endless fascination for me, and I think for my publication as well. Neoconservatism is actually just one strain of the American Jewish right. And neoconservatism defined as kind of the turn that Irving Kristol represented as, you know, against the welfare state and against campus radicalism and so on, is just one part of it. Really hardcore Zionism is a different part of it. And avaricious capitalism, not to play into anti-Semitic tropes, but might be another. But another one is the Jewish embrace of whiteness going to its logical extreme in the form of white supremacy and just outright racism. Podhoretz is interesting because he did come up as a liberal intellectual with actual chops, but he established a precedent for rejecting your liberal Jewish milieu in favor of the right, which I still see people, you know, roughly our age following the same trajectory. And I mean, I knew some I won't name growing up, but as far as public examples of this, Ben Shapiro is one. He's a bit older, but Andrew Breitbart. Ben Shapiro and Andrew Breitbart are both from LA. Stephen Miller is from Southern California, I believe. And these guys aren't all precisely the same, but I would say they all have some basic factors in common. They all grew up affluent Jewish in assimilated Southern California in an era, maybe the best era in modern history to be born a Jew. And they've all embraced, to varying degrees of explicitness, white supremacy. I would say Shapiro in particular has been ludicrously touted in the New York Times as an intellectual. He's quite dumb, I think, and mediocre in every respect. And honestly, I think if he didn't have a Jewish name, I wonder if anyone would bother to call him an intellectual.
Well, he wears a kippah.
Yeah, sure. But these guys are following this Podhoretz and Crystal template of where I think central to their conservatism is not just white supremacy and everything else that attends conservatism today, but this perception that everyone is a liberal, right? Because they're growing up in these affluent Jewish communities where liberalism is normalized. And so they think they're bold free thinkers because they rejected that. Now, the reality is they're embracing a kind of lowest common denominator white American thinking full of moral, ethical, and intellectual flaws. But in their mind, they've done something brave by defying their community.
Admirable.
Yeah. And you can see that in Podhoretz, this sense. I mean, you can see it in My Negro Problem and Ours. It's basically a white guy admitting that he's a racist who's scared of, but also fascinated by black people. But he thinks that's a bold, intellectually sophisticated statement because all the white, mostly Jewish people around him are committed to the civil rights movement. And so he's saying something that they're all afraid to say.
That's very interesting.
And it really is, we've talked about this before on the show, the dominant intellectual style of the right is owning the libs, right? And posing as these brave truth tellers who are willing to say the sometimes shocking things that soft brain progressives and their endless empathy and niceness refuse to actually articulate.
And in order to believe that, in order to believe that you're the underdog and you're the hero, you have to believe that high culture is where power actually lies. You have to believe that, like, the Academy and maybe Hollywood and TV and stuff.
Blue checks on Twitter.
That's where real power lies. Real power doesn't lie in the fact that the Republican Party, despite being unpopular in its policies and just actually as a party by any measure, controls almost every lever of political power in our society. You know, to me, I look at the American political system and I say, the right is clearly winning the battles over who gets to make decisions about everything that affects our lives. But that's not real power to people like Podhoretz. Real power is HBO. Real power is Harvard. Real power is Hollywood. You know, whether you get ratioed for saying something politically incorrect on Twitter or not. I think most liberal and left intellectual types find this very puzzling, this notion that we have power. It doesn't feel that way.
Yeah, I often think to myself, especially I did a whole day of like accounting for my year of freelancing. And I thought, like, where can I go to exchange my cultural capital for real capital? Like, is there a bank I can go to where
it's the same bank you check your Soros check from?
Yeah. No, I get direct deposit from Soros.
Oh, right.
So.
Yeah.
Well, what's hilarious about that, and what really gets to a core contradiction of neoconservative thought, I think, is, as we were discussing earlier with, like, pay rates in the 50s and stuff, by any measure, all of the sort of material and institutional barometers of the culture industry have just precipitously declined over the course of our millennial lifetimes, right? Like it is shittier to be an academic now than it was 30 years ago. It's shittier to be a journalist or freelance writer or anything like cultural critic than it was 30 years ago, and certainly than it was 60 years ago. I mean, not, I should stipulate, if you're from underprivileged background, there are opportunities that weren't there before. But in a in terms of what you can get paid and how much like actual clout you have in the culture, it's worse.
A dark thing to acknowledge is that in some ways, journalism industry, culture industry, like made itself maximally available to people of underprivileged and vulnerable backgrounds at exactly the moment where it was no longer a way to actually make money.
Right. And many people would say that's not a coincidence, that those two things are intimately linked. But without getting too far afield on that, the neocons, especially the first generation of neocons that includes Norman Podhoretz, is so interesting because they venerate cultural capital. To them, cultural capital is, you know, they built their own lives around it. They think it's important. And we've said a few times, Norman Podhoretz thought literary criticism was where the action was, which seems so laughable in retrospect. But these are the same kinds of people who will today say, you know, you're an idiot if you take out student loans to become a literary critic, like, and who will make fun of the kind of person who would do that. They have weirdly poisoned and destroyed and undervalued the exact cultural milieu that they came up in and that they claim to value so much.
Well, that might be a good place to stop. I do just want to emphasize, I do want to emphasize again for our listeners, despite all the criticisms of Norman Podhoretz we've leveled, this is kind of an amazing book. And I admit I have a taste for this sort of gossip, you might say. But too, I had read this when this book was re-released in 2017. I bought it and read it and was really bowled over by it. And now when we were preparing for this episode, I thought, oh, I'll just flip through pages, skim a little bit. No, I basically read the whole damn book again.
The last thing I want to say about this book and Norman Podhoretz is that I think when lefty intellectual types, despite knowing better, develop a weird affection for conservative or right-wing figures, it's often because for their many flaws, their many prejudices, the many abhorrent personal qualities they have, They do often have a really great nose for the hypocrisies and shortcomings of liberalism, which are real and which the left confronts often. And Norman Podhoretz, I think, seems like an awful person, a narcissist, dry drunk who's never come to terms with that, you know, someone who raised a repulsive son, and someone who stands for global world war and racism and Islamophobia and lots of other things. He sucks. I don't like him. But I did like his book. And one reason I like it is because it's a period of his life where he really honestly tried to be himself, which a lot of writers never achieve. And he also trolled and scandalized the liberal elite of the time and saw through them in some ways that they weren't prepared to admit about themselves and that hold up surprisingly well 50 years later. So, or 52 years later. So for all those reasons, I think if you read this book carefully, there's a lot to be learned from it.
Well, that's a good place to end. Thank you, David, for coming on.
Thank you guys so much. This was a blast.
So